Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and during the next half-hour segment, and in fact during the next two half-hour segments, we're going to examine fascism around the world and also through the ages. I guess one could term this program with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek reference, quote, Eurofascism, unquote. We are going to be examining fascism in Europe, all around Europe. We're also going to be examining how the euro may affect fascism, that, however, very briefly. However, we're going to examine Eurofascism in America, i.e. fascism in America of a type that has historically been connected to fascism in Europe. So, again, fascism around the world and through the ages is going to be the focal point of the next two half-hour segments. Without further ado, let's proceed. There was a very important election in part of what used to be East Germany, specifically Saxony-Anhalt. The research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the vitally important Germany Alert newsletter. I also want to note that coverage of this particular electoral result was carried in many, many newspapers in the U.S. and elsewhere, so it shouldn't be too hard to dig up articles about this. This is from the Germany Alert newsletter of April 27th of 1998. It's datelined Magdeburg, M-A-G-D-E-B-U-R-G, and headlined Pro-Nazi DVU wins 13% in Saxony-Anhalt election. The DVU is the Deutsche Volksunion. This, by the way, is essentially a Nazi party in Germany. More about the DVU in a minute. Raging forces of anti-foreigner, anti-Semitic, anti-gay hate have inflicted a hideous victory upon Saxony-Anhalt, polling some 13% of the vote for the pro-Nazi German People's Union, or DVU, in state elections. DVU boss Gerhard Frey, F-R-E-Y, a multimillionaire publisher who has been a leader of pro-Nazi forces in Germany for decades, will see 14 of his party's members in the state parliament. DVU candidates campaigned with slogans like, "Foreigner bandits get out," and "German money for German jobs" in the eastern state, where even official statistics now show a record 22.6% of the workforce have no jobs. By the way, I want listeners to note very carefully the rhetoric being used by fascists in Europe, including some of the Nazis in Germany, because I want to stress very carefully and emphatically the continuity both rhetorically and ideologically between the fascist powers currently, the fascist parties currently coming to the fore in Europe, and the supposedly respectable Republican Party of the United States, which is itself a fascist party at this point somewhat to the right of Mussolini. Please note the ideological and rhetorical continuity between these, quote, extremist, unquote, fascist and Nazi parties in Europe and the, quote, respectable, unquote, Republican Party in the United States. Continuing. Of the unemployment in Saxony-Anhalt, unofficial estimates put real employment close to 50% and much higher still for young voters. Pro-Nazis ran a well-financed campaign that included pamphlets for every household, wall posters throughout the state, and even leaflets dropped from aircraft. Exit polls showed that up to 30% of voters under 30 years old voted for the pro-Nazis. And again, I think that is a very, very important electoral result. It has been predictably, its significance has been predictably minimized by media critics, in particular in this country, pointing out that this is only one particular part of Germany, and the former East Germany is bedeviled by very, very high unemployment. All of Europe, including Germany and France, are experiencing very high unemployment. And around the world, including in the United States, the economic distress being caused by corporations downsizing and or moving major manufacturing facilities to countries where they can take advantage of cheaper labor costs is not only causing economic distress, but it's causing political dissatisfaction, and that is promoting the rise of fascism around the world, including and especially here in the United States. Some of the connections between German and American fascism were underscored in a book called The Man Who Knew Too Much. This is arguably the, certainly the most comprehensive, arguably the best single volume about the assassination of President Kennedy. The book The Man Who Knew Too Much was authored by Dick Russell, published in hardcover and softcover by Carroll and Graff Publishers, copyright 1992. The ISBN number is 0-88184-900-6. And in The Man Who Knew Too Much, there is a discussion of the fact that the misinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly fired at former Major General Edwin Walker, an extreme right-winger in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, that misinformation, which was floated by the Warren Commission in order to give the impression that Lee Harvey Oswald was not a politically motivated assassin when he allegedly slew the liberal President Kennedy, because he had also allegedly tried to kill the ultra-right right-wing General Walker. Well, in fact, there are serious problems with the notion of Oswald's having fired at Walker, and I think the following passage from The Man Who Knew Too Much will make clear just what those problems are. The first mention, Dick Russell writes in The Man Who Knew Too Much, the first mention of Oswald's attempt on Walker had appeared in the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung, a right-wing newspaper out of Munich, West Germany, on November 29, 1963. Yet Marina Oswald would not tell her story to the FBI until 4 days later, purportedly the first awareness anybody had of it. Assassination researcher Peter Dale Scott's look into the newspaper's history revealed that it had several ex-Nazis and ex-SS men on its staff, and a long arm into American far-right circles. Its editor, Gerhard Frey, capital F-R-E-Y, was closely tied in Munich to the Ukrainian ABN, as well as to two men whose names show up among General Willoughby's correspondents, Dr. Theodor Oberlander and Walter Becker. General Willoughby, nee Wiedenbach, was a German-born fascist who was General MacArthur's chief of intelligence from 1939 to 1950. He also was a major figure in the American far-right and international fascist circles. Theodor Oberlander, a former SS officer, was a German cabinet minister for ex-ballet until his role in liquidating Jewish populations in the former Soviet Union came to light. And Dr. Walter Becker, the infamous Dr. B, was a Sudeten German fascist who had much to do with the arranging the Nazi takeover of the Sudetenland in what used to be Czechoslovakia. Please note, however, that supposedly Marina Oswald disclosed the Walker-Oswald connection to the light of day on December 3rd of 1963, yet Gerhard Frey had that information published 4 days before that. He got his information from General Walker. I would note that Gerhard Frey and the Nazi elements that of which he was a part are very profoundly connected to their American fascist counterparts, which is not to say that Americans or Germans are necessarily fascist, but fascism is obviously not alien to either country, and I want to emphasize that German fascist elements have very strong connections to their American counterparts, and in fact not only the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that was incorporated into U.S. intelligence at the end of the war, but also the Ethnic Outreach Council of the Republican Party, literally a Nazi wing of the U.S. Republican Party, very closely connected to the Gehlen organization and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, basically a reworking of Adolf Hitler's committee of It was an organization put together by Adolf, the Committee of Subjugated Nations. Was what Adolf Hitler called the organization, his consortium of Central and Eastern European fascists, that was renamed the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations at the end of World War II. That was later incorporated into the former World Anti-Communist League, and those types of elements, the Central and Eastern European fascists, such as the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Romanian Iron Guard, and various Gehlen elements, constitute what is literally a Nazi wing of the U.S. Republican Party today, which is viewed as being able to deliver the key vote in five swing states. There's a miscellaneous archive show called Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign that talks about that. Also, a two-hour interview with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews. Both of those tapes are available from Spitfire for those who would like to peruse the documentation. In addition, Gerhard Frey himself was very close to the aforementioned former Nazi Major General Reinhard Gehlen. Again, Gehlen was in charge of all Third Reich intelligence for the Eastern Front in World War II. He then jumped to first U.S. intelligence, then NATO, and finally the Federal Republic of Germany, with his organization basically intact, the derivative and residua of Adolf Hitler's Eastern Front intelligence organization, the Gehlen organization very closely connected to the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground. The connections between Gehlen, the Odessa, and in turn between Gehlen's organization Organization and Gerhard Fry are discussed in a vitally important recent book entitled The Beast Reawakens. That book was authored in hardcover by Martin A. Lee. Copyright 1997, published by Little Brown Incorporated. There are, by the way, four different one-hour interviews that I've recorded with Martin Lee. Those are available from Spitfire. The ISBN number for The Beast Reawakens is 0-316-51959-6. And in The Beast Reawakens, there's a discussion of the connections between Gerhard Fry and Reinhard Galen. Galen's organization finally wound up as the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the German intelligence service. The connection here is between Russian fascist Vladimir Zhirinovsky and Gerhard Fry. Fry was one of the major funding sources for Zhirinovsky's rise in the former Soviet Union. Later on in this program, time permitting, we will be talking about fascism and its rise in some of the former Soviet republics as well. Of the Zhirinovsky-Fry and Fry-Galen connections, Martin A. Lee writes as follows. Although Zhirinovsky later spoke of destroying Germany with nuclear weapons if it got out of line, his close association with the DVU, that's the party that just won 13% in Saxony-Anhalt, was beneficial to both parties. The Russian got much-needed cash, while Fry, a marginal figure in German politics, gained extensive media attention by rubbing shoulders with Zhirinovsky. This enhanced Fry's reputation among German neo-Nazi groups, which had quarreled with the DVU during the Cold War because of its support for NATO and the NATO alliance. Even before he formed the DVU in 1971, with the professed objective to, quote, save Germany from communism, unquote, Fry received behind-the-scenes support from General Reinhard Galen, Bonn's powerful spy chief. But after the superpower face-off ended, the DVU Führer quickly shifted gears and demanded that Germany leave NATO. His newspapers began to run inflammatory articles that denounced the United States and praised Russia as a more suitable partner for post-Cold War Germany. Fry also joined the chorus of neo-Nazi agitators who expressed solidarity with Saddam Hussein and condemned the U.S.-led war against Iraq in 1991. I want to not only underscore those powerful international connections of Gerhard Fry, far more than just a, quote, neo-Nazi, unquote. Rather, his roots also go back to the Third Reich, and he is very strongly connected to American national security and far-right interests as well. As I mentioned, I want to underscore the similarity in rhetoric and ideology between some of the overtly fascist parties currently gaining strength in Europe and the supposedly respectable Republican Party in the United States. As you listen to some of the political rhetoric being bandied about by some of these Euro-fascists, please note the similarity in not only rhetoric but tactics and ideology to Republicans in the United States. Turning once again to the Germany Alert newsletter, and once again research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience, this deals with the racist and anti-foreigner tone that's currently coming out of the German government in Berlin, and I want to stress that we have something very similar coming not from Bill Clinton, but coming from the American right wing and the Republican Party as well. This is datelined Berlin, May 4th of 1998, and Germany Alert comments as follows about the mainstreaming of German fascism. This is entitled, A Racist, Anti-Foreigner Tone from Berlin's Government. Words and phrases spewing from the mouths of top Berlin Christian Democrats and Social Democrats are becoming more reminiscent of the Nazis than of Western world politicians. Interior Senator Jörg Schönbaum, a CDU leader who's in charge of the heavily militarized Berlin police force, refuses to find any place in the city for Roma and Sinti gypsies to live, and targets, quote, foreigners, unquote, for regular massive ID controls right downtown. Schönbaum cynically calls himself the, quote, commissioner for inlanders, unquote, an ugly play on words in a city in which a real-life commissioner for foreigners is responsible for investigating racist practices against non-Germans. Over the weekend, Schönbaum said he is considering restricting freedom of assembly in Berlin following a night of confrontation between 6,000 young May Day revelers, some of them ready for violence, and at least 5,000 heavily armed police. As the Daily Frankfurter Rundschau points out, basic freedoms are already being eroded by politicians who run Berlin. The paper lists human dignity, freedom of speech, and freedom from discrimination on the grounds of color or gender. Nazi-like phrases emanate from SPD politicians who incite racial hate by claiming the city is being overrun by, quote, floods, unquote, or even a, quote, tidal wave, unquote, of refugees. Bear in mind similar rhetoric here in the United States from the Republican Party and other like-minded elements. Continuing. From CDU Social Affairs Senator Beata Hübner, ranting about, quote, foreigner welfare tricksters, unquote. And from Berlin CDU boss Klaus Landowski, calling Eastern European immigrants, quote, rabble, unquote, in public forums. It's the kind of talk that swept Adolf Hitler into power. I agree with that. It's also the kind of talk we're hearing from the Republican Party and similarly minded elements here in the United States today. It's one of the reasons why I'm engaging in this study of connections between American fascism and, quote, Eurofascism, unquote. An article which underscored the connections between supposedly respectable, quote, conservative, unquote, politicians in the United States and their overtly fascist counterparts in Europe and around the world was touched on in the British anti-fascist magazine The Searchlight. By the way, The Searchlight is not to be confused with the American Spotlight. The Searchlight is British and anti-fascist, and the Spotlight is American and pro-fascist, all despite its populist pretenses. In the aforementioned The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, there's a good discussion of the ideological and functional links between residual Third Reich elements such as the Deadly Odessa Network and the Liberty Lobby, the parent organization of the Spotlight. We're going to turn now again to The Searchlight. Again, that's a British anti-fascist publication. This is an article from The Searchlight's issue of April of 1998. By the way, they have a website. For those of you who are on the World Wide Web, it's www.slight.demon.co.uk. Again, that's the British Searchlight. Their address, by the way, 37B, as in boy, New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR. Once again, that 37B, New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR. And in the Searchlight's issue of April of 1998, in the Searchlight Around the World section, there's an article about the Italian Fascist Congress in Verona. The Italian Fascist Party is called the Alleanza Nazionale, or National Alliance. That is the direct successor to Mussolini's Fascist Party. The residua, the reconstituted, I should say, Italian Fascist Party was originally named the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, but they overtly trumpeted their role as the direct successor to Mussolini. The AN, the Alleanza Nazionale, although the direct successor to Mussolini, is going out of its way to try to make itself out to be a, quote, respectable, unquote, conservative or mainstream party. There are a number of significant things about the recent Congress of the AN in Verona. I want to once again stress the similarity in the fascist rhetoric that the AN is adopting to the rhetoric of the Republican Party and the right wing in the United States. And I also want to stress that present at this Congress, again, the official Congress of the Italian Fascist Party in Verona, two of the people in attendance were U.S. member of the House of Representatives Bob Young of the Republican Party, and Udi Cohen from Israel, a member of the Likud Party in Israel, that in turn is the heir to the fascist element within the Zionist movement, about which we will have more to say in a minute. This particular article is entitled Likud Greets Feeney's Fascist Congress, and it concerns, among other things, U.S. Republican Representative Bob Young and Udi Cohen representing their respective parties at this fascist Congress. The article reads in part, "It was the, quote, new, unquote, face of Italian fascism which dominated the official proceedings of the fascist Alleanza Nazionale's three-day assembly in Verona in February. More than 2,000 AN members and supporters attended, many personally invited and representing a cross-section of Italian business and industry. Gianfranco Fini, leader of the AN, was reportedly pleased with the results. Well to the fore in shaping both presentation and content was Domenico Fisichella, F-I-S-I-C-H-E-L-L-A, one of Fini's key strategists. His role in the AN has become increasingly prominent as his leader tries to replace the AN's black shirt image with a more respectable white-shirted one. Since the purge that took place at the AN's inaugural Congress at Fiuggi in January of 1995, Feeney has more than doubled the electoral support commanded by his party's successor, the openly fascist MSI. He's been able to mobilize up to 100,000 supporters onto the streets and is well on his way to establishing himself as the leader of the Italian right. Fisichella, a former Christian Democrat, has laid the basis for the AN's political respray by wrapping traditional fascism in terms such as the crisis of the Italian birth rate, unquote, the decline of patriotic values, unquote, decaying multi-ethnicity, unquote, and the crumbling Tower of Babel of pluriculture, unquote. And again, note the similarity between the rhetoric of the Italian Fascist Party and the Republican Party in the far right in the United States. Continuing. Of that rhetoric, the article comments, these concepts are echoed by Feeney himself. He constantly refers to the dangers of one-worldism, unquote, by which he is referring to the supposed onslaught of immigration, unquote, from the Third World to Europe. Basing his arguments on the rising number of elderly people in Europe, coupled with falling birth rates among Europeans, Feeney appeals to fears that white, Catholic cultural values will be replaced by the alien values of a rising, non-white, immigrant population. The old racist propaganda, well packaged in bogus socio-cultural and economic jargon. It is armed with such ideas that Feeney wants to install the AN as Italy's biggest single political party. For his project to reach success, however, Feeney must fill two objectives. Having defeated and restrained internal opposition within the AN, he must neutralize his rivals on the fragmented Italian right, and he must win new allies abroad. The second aim shows sign of a breakthrough. Present in Verona were the U.S. Republican Congressman Bob Young, who compared Feeney's wisdom with that of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan, and Udi Cohen from the right-wing Likud party in Israel, who brought greetings from his party. By the way, again, note that Bob Young, a Republican member of the House of Representatives, was there unofficially representing the Republican Party of the United States, and Udi Cohen was there officially representing the Likud party from Israel, and he communicated his party's greetings. Skipping down, while Young and Cohen were praising Feeney in Verona, Alleanza Nazionale delegates outside the auditorium were signing petitions calling for the release of the Nazi war criminal Erich Priebke. The AN paper Il Secolo was calling the supporters of the SS-installed Salo Republic defenders of Italian honor, unquote. And Azione Giovanni, the AN's youth group, was on the internet promoting the writings of Evola, Codrianu, and de Grel. By the way, again, note the presence at the official Congress of the Italian Fascist Party of Bob Young, a member of the Republican House of a Republican member of the House of Representatives. Again, I've noted that there's an entire wing of the Republican Party, the Ethnic Outreach Council, that's a direct outgrowth of European fascism, the Third Reich in particular. What I want to note is that for the Republican Party, the American right wing, to express its solidarity with Mussolini is nothing unusual. There are numerous archive shows in which I discuss the affinity between American reactionaries and Italian fascists and Mussolini. In a half-hour segment entitled A Tribute to George Seldes, arguably the most important American investigative journalist of the 20th century, there's a discussion by an attempt by Herbert Hoover to court-martial Major General Smedley Butler, a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor and the man who foiled the 1934 fascist coup attempt in the United States. This half-hour segment is available from Spitfire, and we're going to listen to it right now for historical perspective. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of excerpts from one of Seldes' books entitled Even the Gods Can't Change History, subtitled The Facts Speak for Themselves. It's by George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S, published by Lyle Stewart and Company out of New Jersey, and this is copyright 1976. In Appendix A of Even the Gods Can't Change History, there is a remarkable anecdote concerning an impending court-martial of the aforementioned Major General Smedley Butler, two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor and a Commandant of the Marine Corps, for having slandered Mussolini in a discussion with President Herbert Hoover. Once again, what we're talking about here is a Major General in the United States Marine Corps facing a court-martial. It was aborted for reasons we'll discuss in a minute. A court-martial for insulting Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. As we've seen in the past, drawing again on the research of George Seldes, Mussolini was named a member of the American Legion, an honorary member of the American Legion in 1935, that nomination later rescinded on a technicality. We're going to discuss Smedley Butler's almost getting court-martialed for having slandered Mussolini to then-President Herbert Hoover right now. In Appendix 4, rather, not Appendix A, Appendix 4 of Even the Gods Can't Change History, we find the following. By the way, most of the information in this book is reprinted from George Seldes' remarkable In Fact series. That was a magazine that he had in the 1930s and 40s. Appendix 4 reads, in 1931, Major General Smedley D. Butler, Commandant of the U.S. Marines, faced court-martial because of an alleged insult to Mussolini. Inasmuch as the present editor of this weekly was in 1931 engaged in writing Sawdust Caesar, he placed at General Butler's disposal the true facts concerning Mussolini. As a result of this association with the Commandant of the Marines, here is a news story which has not yet been told. President Hoover wanted to court-martial General Butler to please fascist Italy. In 1931, in a speech in Philadelphia, Butler had repeated a story previously told by Cornelius Vanderbilt, that while Mussolini and he were driving through an Italian town, the Duce was a confessed speed lawbreaker. He ran over a child and then made the following remark. Never look backward, Vanderbilt. Unquote. What is one life in the affairs of state? Again, unquote. Butler called Mussolini a wild, mad dog, unquote. Hoover ordered Secretary of the Navy Charles Adams to prefer charges. If found guilty, General Butler could have been dismissed or given 15 years imprisonment. When In Fact's editor gave General Butler the documented history of Mussolini's political murders, including the Filippelli confession of Mussolini's part in the assassination of Matteotti, General Butler said he did not think President Hoover would ever let the case come to trial. Interrupting, we've dealt with the assassination of Member of Parliament Matteotti, a socialist deputy in the Italian Parliament, who exposed the connections between Mussolini and many of the top industrialists and financiers of Italy, at whose will, Mussolini did what he did. Basically, as George Seldes, whose work we drew upon in the archive show of Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. We drew on not only the book Sawdust Caesar, alluded to here, but also Can These Things Be? From 1931. And the assassination of Matteotti was discussed in that miscellaneous archive show available from Archives on Audio. Continuing with this segment of Even the Gods Can't Change History, Hoover sent his aide to see me, said Butler. I said, put me on the stand and you'll hear the story of the Boxer Rebellion, unquote. That was all. General Butler was released almost immediately. And George Seldes goes on to describe a very shameful episode during the Boxer Rebellion in which Herbert Hoover, then an engineer, was basically found cowering in a corner when General Butler Tianjin with the United States Marines discovered him. I'm not going to go into the particulars concerning Herbert Hoover's cowardice. Yes, Didi. We will be going into more about Eurofascism in the next half-hour segment. Please note, by the way, that recorded in July of 1995 and available from Spitfire, by the way. Archives on Audio is now defunct. It is not unusual for American politicians to view Italian fascists with kindness. We're going to talk more about global fascism through the ages in the next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.